Good morning. My name is Brian. I'm an alcoholic. And before I get completely self-absorbed, I'd like to thank Hector, and I will. It's the nature of the beast. I'd like to thank Hector for inviting me out here on a Sunday morning. So much for moving to the west side for the cool weather in the summer. But I got to tell you, I was driving here this morning, and I was on the 405, and I saw there was a car on the road, and it was the most alcoholic thing I ever saw. It was like a 1980 Cutlass Sierra with Texas plates. And in the window it had, you know, printing. And it said, impressionist comedian, vocal impressionist comedian. It said, call such and such a number, hire for weddings, parties, funerals. And I started thinking, who the hell would call this guy for a funeral? I know who. We would, you know? So mom's dead, flowers, casket, impressionist comedian. Yeah, okay, you know. Just whatever. But at any rate, I am an alcoholic. That's probably the most important thing I can convey here this morning. And, you know, and I know I'm an alcoholic for a number of reasons. First off, you know, I've been sober 22 years. And I have a good life. I have a really good job. I have a lovely wife. I have two good kids. I have a nice house and a pool. And, you know, I rolled up in an Infiniti today. And I'm not particularly happy, you know. Anybody else with my life would be, you know, I mean, at least okay about it, you know. It's never enough. Use a bigger car. Bigger wife. I don't know. You know, there's just something, there's something terribly wrong with me. And, you know, I think in the South they would say, you know, that dog don't hunt. You know, you just go into a room of people and you know that there's something wrong with you. You know, and this is the thing that's plagued me about being an alcoholic all my life is, I mean, well into sobriety. I mean, I've been a leader in Indian guides. And, you know, you're sitting there with all these kids and parents and you're thinking, do they have any idea, you know, I mean, who I am or what I am? And apparently they don't, because we're good at acting. And, you know, we act better than we feel. You know, the other reason I know I'm an alcoholic is because I like to drink. And, you know, I've been sober 22 years, and I've got to be honest, I've thought more about drinking in the last 2 years than I have in the 20 years prior to that, you know. And I think a lot of that has to do with, you know, people that I see that go out with time generally don't go out because something bad's happened. They get out because their life goes good. And they take credit for that. And, you know, I am quick to take credit for anything that good that happens in my life. You know, I picked that wife, I got that job, I held it, you know. That's not true. I'm a goof by nature. You know, my wife says I have a theme song, and it goes like this. And it's true, I'm Mortimer Snerd that got sober. And, you know, anything that's good in my life is a result of AA and Alcoholics Anonymous and doing the steps and having a sponsor, you know. But I am quick to take credit for it. And if I always take credit for it, one day I'll decide that I don't need AA and I'll walk away and eventually I'll drink, you know. And I have to remember that on a daily basis. Another reason I know I'm an alcoholic is a few years ago I was in a supermarket. It was like a Bonds. And I was in the checkout line. And no, I didn't shoot an old lady for having too many items. But there was a fellow in front of me, and he was retired, shall we say. And I used to say he was old, but now that I'm 53, I'm not. You know. He was in his golden years. He was in his prime. And in his basket, he had about 9 or 10 bottles of, you know, Vaughn's own label vodka, you know, the good kind. And the other thing he has, he had just a big stack of Banquet chicken pot pies. And I remember those Banquet chicken pot pies. They used to, you know, they used to be like 30 cents. I mean, and that was all he had in his basket. And, you know, my first reaction was, you know, how sad. I mean, this is what his life's come down to. And you could kind of, because I'm very good at imagining, and, you know, well, I'm very good at judging. So, You know, what I saw was this guy had, you know, he got his Social Security check. He probably had a room, you know, that he paid for in advance. And then he had his vodka. And he had these, you know, chicken pot pies, you know, these bags, and that's what he lived on. And my first feeling was how sad, how unfortunate. My second thought was, this guy's got it made. He's figured it out, you know. He'll live to a ripe old age. And you know, because you get that check, you pay for the room in advance, you got your booze, and those chicken pot pies have everything you need to live. If you look part of it, there's a pea somewhere inside of it. There's a little bit of chicken somewhere. You know, and that's how I know I'm an alcoholic, because that life, that appeals to me. You know, I have a friend that talks about from the podium how when he came into AA, he was single, and he was living in a room, and you know, and he didn't have a job, and you know, now he's married, and he's got kids, and he's got a good job, and sometimes he wishes he was single and living in a room and didn't have a job, and I understand that, you know. We do not handle responsibility well. I mean, we can do it, you know, but I don't think it's natural to us, and certainly not to me. But, you know, that's one of the reasons I'm an alcoholic, and I was born in Canada, chapter one, I am born. I was born in Canada. My father was a member of the Royal Canadian Air Force, and through adversity to the stars. And he was a sergeant with four kids. I have three older sisters. The oldest one's an alcoholic. We found out on national TV. we were watching a documentary on the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation about a halfway house in Vancouver, and there was a circle of ex-hookers and my sister on national TV. My sister is a geriatric nurse, so she's told us. And not that there's anything wrong with being an ex-hooker. It was just, you know, kind of astonishing to see your sister on national TV telling everybody that she's an alcoholic because she hadn't told us. And she's still sober today, and I have a middle sister who I wish was an alcoholic. She's been going to a psychiatrist, you know, every week for the past 30 years. She has the same problem that she went to that psychiatrist 30 years ago, and she has yet to find a solution. And her problem was she grew up in the same house I did, you know. And I wish she was an alcoholic because there is a solution here, you know. Yes, this happened. Get over it. Move on, you know. And that's not something she wants to hear. And I have a younger, the youngest sister who is perfectly normal. We don't know what's the matter with her. She's well-balanced and probably adopted. And my mother was an alcoholic, and she died as a result of this disease. And my father was a natural-born Al-Anon, you know. I've always wanted to have the, you know, the military brat story about, you know, the vicious sergeant father that, you know, lined us up. He's a kind and gentle and loving man. So, you know, I have nobody to blame for my alcoholism. I have nobody to blame for my alcoholism. I like the taste of alcohol, and I like the effect that it has on me. We grew up in the frozen north, and at the age of 14 in 1968, my father retired and decided he wanted to live in a Mediterranean climate, and so we moved to California in 1968. And in 1968, if you were from anywhere else, California was the place to be. We take it for granted now, but in 1968, this was La La Land. I mean, you know, Disneyland was here. Let me tell you, when you're 14, that's a big thing, you know. You mean live near Disneyland? I mean, you just can't even imagine that. And the music was from here, you know, the hippies were here. The movie, everything seemed to be in Los Angeles, especially when you're somewhere near the tundra line. And so we moved here, and my father, in his infinite wisdom, moved us into the middle of the Canoga Park barrio. And I learned to run to school every day and run home. And and I went to high school, and I was a straight, you know, and I was pathetic. I had green pants and blue pants and cardigan sweaters, and, you know, that was not the dress code for Canoga Park, I'll tell you that. And, yeah, I begged them for a pair of jeans and a t-shirt. And in 10th grade, I was a straight-A student. I was very politically aware. I was against the war. You remember that war, you know. And seems about the same, doesn't it? And I was against the war, and somebody asked me if I wanted to get high. And I had never done anything my idea of a good time on a Saturday night was a bag of chips that I didn't have to share with anybody. You know, I mean, but I was, I knew that it should be legalized, so therefore I should try it out. And so I started smoking pot, and I loved it. I loved it right away. And, you know, and my argument about drugs and alcohol is if you can feel like this, why would you ever want to feel like you do when you wake up? You know, I mean, to alcoholics, it seems relatively clear, I think, you know. I can feel normal or I can feel better, you know. And I remember 2 weeks later, I had an argument with my junior high, my high school vice principal about whether marijuana led to hard drugs. And I argued that, no, they didn't. Now, in that 2 weeks, I had gone from marijuana to mescaline to acid to speed to Lilia 42nd, you know. So, you know, but I made the argument anyway. And the one thing I didn't want to do is drink because my mother was an alcoholic. And, you know, back then in 1970, things were very clear. There was us. We had long hair, remember? You know, when we had hair. And I had long hair. And, you know, we were against this and we were for that. And we did these things, you know. And then there was them. And they were, well, they look like me now, you know. And they were my age now, you know. And... you know, it was just a black and white world. It was us and them, you know, and they drank, you know, and I didn't want to be one of them. Well, I went along for a few years just doing the us thing, you know, I want to tell you, if you're new here tonight, and I hope you stay, I absolutely hope you stay, but I found, you know, I had some experiences. I used to like LSD a lot, and that's a quick emotional check. And I remember going to a party once. I heard the word party. I went. Apparently it was a Tupperware party. And they were snapping the seals while I was peeking on acid. And being Canadian, I'm too polite to leave. I just stayed and bought something and then left. And, you know, I had a lot of fun. And I was very attracted to amphetamines. Now, I weighed 119 pounds, and I was 6 feet tall, and I had long blonde hair. I looked like a praying mantis with a wig. And people would say, I think I can sue you. I mean, you know. And somewhere along the line, somebody gave me some wild turkey. And that changed my mind about everything. Because... you know, the drugs do certain things. They make you go fast, they make you go slow, they put you over here, whatever they do, you know. But only alcohol makes me not care. And that's what I was looking for. Because I used to say that I was painfully self-conscious. I've since learned that I'm painfully self-centered. And, like, right up to now, this moment, for instance. And only alcohol relieved me of myself. I, for the first time in my life, I didn't care about what you thought about me. Even better, I didn't even care what I thought about me. And that is the sweetest relief, I think, to this day, that you can get, you know, to just not care, you know, because that shuts off everything. And I, like I say, I was horrible. I mean, I used to think of myself in the third person. This is how painfully self, you know, Brian is giving a pitch at an AA podium. I mean, you know, I just was horribly self-centered. And I always liken it to when you learned how to drive. I don't know if the first time you ever got on the freeway, you know, you have a tendency to want to look right over the hood to the road right in front of you, and you can't drive in a straight line that way. You have to look down the road, you know. And that's what living with that kind of self-centeredness is like, you know. You can't look down the road. You're just all over it because you can't get past here, you know. And alcohol relieved that for me. And so that quickly became my drug of choice. And alcohol worked for me. I mean, I was, 17 years old. I was chock full of hormones, as 17-year-olds are. And, you know, being 119 pounds, I wasn't exactly a football hero. And, you know, I believe I'd be a virgin today if it wasn't for alcohol. And looking over the crowd, perhaps some of you. No. I found that when I drank, I could talk. If I could talk, I could make a girl laugh. If she was laughing, She didn't know where my hands were, and the next thing you know, I had a girlfriend. I mean, it was just magic. And, you know, so along those lines, I got married at the age of 19, and because I thought I'd seen and done it all. And I'd been living on my own since the age of 15, and so that was why I got that impression. But I married a girl. It was an interracial marriage. She was Irish, and she was off the boat Irish. I mean, thick Irish accent Irish, you know, and beautiful girl, most amazingly well-read person I ever met. Had some deep psychological problems, but I can fix that, you know. I have that power. And, you know, I married her, and one of the things I liked about her, she didn't drink or use, which is great, because there's only room in the budget for, you know, and why spend money on her, you know? And so we got married. I married her in Toronto, and I brought her down to California, and she was kind of a miserable person, is the best way to describe it. And after 3 months of marriage, she picked up a bottle of wine and downed it in about 20 seconds. And unbeknownst to me, I had married a violent Irish alcoholic. I mean, I'm an alcoholic. You know how those things, like when you're drunk, you look at somebody and go, that guy is drunk, you know? and she was 5'10", and she was, you know, she clearly outweighed me, and she could slam me up against a wall at any given time. And anyway, so I decided the marriage wasn't working. I called her father back in Canada, and I said, listen, I'm going to send Marion back, you know, like a bad package, really. And he said, well, what's the matter, lad? And I said, you know, it's just not working out. And he said, well, have you tried beating her, lad? And this explained a lot of her deep emotional problems, of course. And I said, no, I haven't. And he said, well, then you haven't given the marriage a proper try. And so I put her on the plane, and you know, I got to tell you, that woman's sober today, and you know, she's been sober about 20 years, and she helps a lot of people in the junior college system get back into school, and you know, but it was the right decision at the time, and you know, and I got to tell you, I stayed legally married for the next 8 years, which, you know, for an alcoholic was probably the best decision I could have made, because I'm the type of person, I'd be on my sixth marriage by now. That's just, you know, how I am. I fall in love easily and often. And I love you, and you know, I love everybody, and you're next, basically. And my idea is, we go on a date, and you know, everything I have is in the back of the car, and it's a long ride home. Why don't I just move in? You know, and I've often heard people, you know, give pitches, and they talk about their ex-wives or ex-husbands, like, that no good. Yeah, he was it, and she was it. The bottom line for me is. I am the common denominator of every bad relationship that I've been in. You know, a lot of really wonderful women did their absolute best to try to love me. But I am unlovable. I am an unlovable alcoholic. I am a black hole of emotional needs. I will suck you dry and in 6 months tell you that it's your fault. You're not cutting it, you know. Because I don't know what the answer is. And I don't know what the problem is, you know. I do know what the problem is now. It's me, you know. And so I went through a series of lovely women and their homes. And and I went through a lot of jobs, too, you know, because I can, at any given point in my drinking, I can put on a jacket and tie and get a job. I just can't keep a job because I have emotional problems that keep me from showing up to work. And, you know, I have been many things over the years. I've held about 40 jobs. My favorite was I was an over-the-counter marital novelty salesman. Batteries are not included. And I know the laws of pandering in California because you had to learn that. And it's the only time I ever took a lie detector test, and they took it not to find out if I had a criminal past. They were trying to find out if I was a cop. And back then, things were, you know, a little dicey. But I got to tell you, my last 2 years of drinking, I met my current wife. I met her at the Red Onion. Perhaps some of you remember the Red Onion. Some of you perhaps remember Big Daddy's and those places. Yeah. But I met her at the Red Onion. I asked her to dance. By the way, when I was drinking, I loved to dance. And when I got sober, the funk was sucked out of my body. You know, I've been able to go bowling sober and do that. I can go to a Dodger game. You know, I've managed to ease into everything that I used to do drinking. You know, but you need to prime the pump to dance. And you know, and she made the mistake that most non-alcoholics make when they meet us. And that is, we appear to be fun. We appear to be more fun than anybody in the room because we're completely insanely drunk. And you know, what a good dancer. You know, well, when I'm drunk, I can dance on the ceiling. I mean, and so we started our courtship, and we got married the old-fashioned way. We had one on the way. And I've heard my wife's Al-Anon talk, and she says, apparently, that she woke up the day after we got married and looked over on the bed and said, oh, my God, I married an alcoholic. Couldn't figure it out the day before when she said, I do, but figured it out the morning after. And by the way, if you have a spouse or a significant other in Al-Anon, I advise don't go listen to their talk. It's not that they're going to expose you for the alcoholic they are. You are. The problem is, they don't talk about you. They talk about themselves, you know, and they're part of the story. And you're sitting there going, you know, well, tell them about the time I, you know, no, it's all about them, their feelings, you know. You know, and for us alcoholics, it's a great disappointment not to hear about yourself all the time. You know? And at any rate, we got married, and our marriage, you know, went to hell immediately because I'm drunk all the time. I'm a daily drinker. For those of you who are periodic, you know, binge drinkers, God bless you. I don't know how you do it. I have to drink every day, you know. The trouble with daily drinking is you don't end up in Guadalajara or Paris, you know, because daily drinking is a grind. You have to, you know. Binge drinking, you can save up some money and wake up in Paris, you know. Daily drinking, you just, you know, you wake up on the floor at your apartment. But anyway, we had our son, and my last 2 years of drinking were characterized. She had asked me not to, she'd read some sort of article, like a Dear Abby or Ann Landers, said an alcoholic, you know, one word, test of an hour, can he not drink 2 days a week? And she said, would you not drink 2 days a week? These are the 2 days. I chose Monday and Wednesday. Nothing consecutive. And here's my Mondays and Wednesdays. I would go to work, and I was working at a job where I got to take people out to lunch and entertain them. And I would call up the biggest drunks I knew in the business that I was in and take them out to lunch. And we'd drink our lunch. And I'd make my way back to the office and leave there at 5 o'clock. I'd stop at Save on Drugstore. I'd get a couple of Michelob. I'd sit in the car and drink those and throw the empties in a basket, you know. And then I'd smoke a lot of cigarettes, you know, chew a lot of gum, which I didn't need to do because my wife was not kissing me at the door. We were, you know, like this. And we would have a tense dinner, and I would play with my son, and I really am not a natural father. You know, my idea of being a father is I'm bigger than you, you know. And then we would need something from the store. I would throw things out to make sure we needed something from the store. You know, we're out of bacon, we're out of coffee, we're out of, you know, I'll throw the toilet paper away just to go get it, you know. And because I had a bottle of Southern Comfort in the trunk of the car, and Southern Comfort doesn't get you drunk, it gets you comfortable. And I would come home and I'd wait for her to go to sleep because she's mortal. And and we live by night, you know. So she would go to sleep, and then I would start drinking until I was drunk enough to go to sleep. And that's the days that I didn't drink, you know. And one day I got a call from my mother, and she said, you know, you better sit down. I got some bad news, you know. My best friend in Canada, Gary, had died in a ultralight aircraft accident. First she just said, you know, Gary died. And I said, well, hang on, Ma. And I put the hand over the phone, and I turned to my wife, and I said, that's my mom. We got some bad news. Gary died. And she goes, oh, my God. And she knew what to do. She was a good wife. She went to the fridge, got me a beer, brought it back. I drank the beer. I got back on the phone, and I said, well, how did he die? You know, because it was more important to use my best friend's death as an excuse for just that beer than it was to find out how he died, you know. And I've had to make amends to him at his gravesite. And at any rate, we continued our lovely way, and in Christmas of 1984, we had a horrible Christmas because I'm drunk around the clock. And she took off with my son to visit her sister. I said, when are you coming back? She said, I really don't know that I'm coming back, you know. And New Year's Eve, I sat with a friend of mine, a bottle of Jack Daniels, and I said, do you think I'm an alcoholic? And this is kind of one of those mood questions, because I know I'm an alcoholic. I've known it for years, you know. And I remember listening to, like, religious programs on the radio, you know, while I'm driving, and, like, put your hand on the radio and ask for, you know, I'd put my hand on, nah, not getting anything, you know. And off we were. There you go. I had heard that my ex-wife had gotten sober through Kaiser, and I had a Kaiser card of $2. So I went to Kaiser and made an appointment and met with a psychologist, and he listened to me for an hour, and he said, well, yeah, you're an alcoholic. He said, are you going to AA meetings? And I said, you know, I never get downtown that often, and which is what I knew about AA, and trench coats downtown, something, you know. And he said, well, listen, you know, where do you live? And I told him. And apparently I lived around the corner from Radford, the old Radford Hall in the valley. And so I went to my first meeting. And what I remember about my first meeting was there was a lot of, like, attractive young girls. This was a great thing, you know. But they all talked about God. This was a very bad thing. And at the end of the meeting, they did the most humiliating thing I could ever imagine. Everybody got up, held hands, prayed out loud publicly. I mean, it just, you know, made my neck kink. And I went to my next meeting, and there was a speaker meeting, and there was some fellow there, and he talked about having left his kid in the car while he went in for a drink and left that kid in the car for 4 hours. I hadn't done that, but I could have done that. You know, and I, for the first time, I identified an Alcoholics Anonymous. And I called my wife, and I said, well, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm going to go to meetings, and she started boo-hooing, and I said, why is this a surprise to you? You've been calling me now? Yeah, whatever. She came home, and I got to tell you, my first 4 years of sobriety, I don't recommend to any of them, you know, especially if you're new. Absolutely do not do this, you know. I went to one, maybe two meetings a week. You know, I showed up late, and I left early. I had a sponsor, because everyone said, get a sponsor, you know, and I would take his advice if I felt like it. And it was kind of salad bar sobriety, you know, you just, yeah, that looks a little strong, I'll pass on that, you know, I know there's a God because I actually stayed sober with that kind of program. It had nothing to do with me, absolutely nothing to do with me. And after 4 years, and by, you know, I would go home and tell my wife, you know, I'm doing this for you, which they don't like to hear. And after 4 years, my life was a complete wreck, which it would be with that kind of program. And not drinking. I was essentially a dry drunk who showed up to one or two meetings a week. And we were about to get divorced. And she had gotten active in Al-Anon. I mean, really active. She had this sponsor that would pick her up on the weekends and take her away for, bring her back Sunday night. And I would go, you know, bring her back when she's fixed, you know. And she said to me, well, before we call the lawyers, would you be willing to meet with my sponsor and her husband? And this guy had like 14 years of sobriety, and I said, that would be fine. So we met over at Charlie Brown's in the Valley, and they had asked me to bring a list of what I expected out of my marriage. And I'm not stupid, you know. I brought a list, and they said, well, okay, read it. And so I said, well, these are the things I expect out of my marriage. I want, you know, love, affection. Guys, you know what affection means. And respect. Respect. And they laughed at me, really loud. The whole restaurant turned around and looked. And they said, these are the things that you bring to a marriage, not that you get from a marriage. And they asked my wife to bring a list, and she's not stupid either, you know, and she asked for the things that most women ask for from their husbands. Responsibility, listen to what I say, and I can never remember the other thing. And they laughed at her, and they said, you know, he's not capable of this. He's an alcoholic. And we were blown out of the water. And we said, well, what do we do? And they said, this is what we do. I'm active in AA. She's active in Al-Anon. We don't get to see each other a lot. That helps. And he said, I am not emotionally attached to my wife. And I, you know, he says, I love my wife, but I do not wake up in the morning, look at her face to decide how my day is going to go. Tough one. Tough one if you're in a relationship, but a great one. And the second, you know, he said, and I was out there and among them when I was drunk, and I am out there among them sober. I go to, you know, like five regular meetings. I have commitments, I play ball with alcoholics, I put on a jacket and tie and I speak and I have fun in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I go to conventions, I am active. And I became sweetly willing. If he had told me to stand on my head for a year in the corner, I would have done it. And instead, I just followed him along. And, and I started pretty much doing what he was doing, not as well, you know, but I got active in AA and my life improved significantly, as it will, you know, if you do those things. And I started sponsoring guys, and part of the problem with being an alcoholic is, for me, you know, my ego lurks just below the surface all the time. And sponsorship taught me some lessons that I never wanted to learn. I was sponsoring a bunch of guys for a while, and my idea of sponsorship was, you know, call me at 7 o'clock, not 7:05, 7 o'clock, you know, whatever. You know, I mean, my ego was in full flare. And I got that call from, you know, this one guy came up to me after our men's stag and said, you know, would you sponsor me? I said, well, let me get right back to you. I called my sponsor and I said, Joe wants me to sponsor him. He said, well, what's the problem there? I said, well, Joe's gay, you know. And he said, is he an alcoholic? And I said, yes, he is. He said, well, you're an idiot, so you go tell Joe you're going to sponsor him. Oh, I just don't know if I'd be suited. Shut up, you know. And I started sponsoring Joe, and Joe was not well. And Joe had AIDS. And here's the thing: my ego. I was so wrapped up in my ego at the time. You know, Joe quit calling me because Joe was very ill. And in my head, you know, I'm your sponsor. You call me, you know, because I was full of this alcoholic ego. And I got a call one day from Joe's mother. She'd come up from South Carolina. Joe was in a hospital. And she called me. She said, yours was the first name in his phone book. Well, my last name starts with an A, so that's a no-brainer, you know. And so I went down to that hospital, and there was nothing to be done for Joe, you know. His father had never accepted his lifestyle, and he stayed in North Carolina. And his mother had come out basically to be with her son while he died. And I left that hospital, and I called my sponsor, and I was crying for Joe, and I was crying for myself for what an ass I'd been. And, you know, and what I wanted to do was walk away from that situation. And I'll start over, you know, with the next guy. I'll be, you know, I've learned my lesson. I'll be real good with the next guy. And my sponsor says, no, you're going to go there every day, you know, and you're going to finish this out. And so I went there every day, and I held Joe's mother's hand until he died. There's nothing much we could do, you know, nothing else I could do. And the lesson that it taught me is, you know, some people come to Alcoholics Anonymous and they find out what good people they are, you know? Once you remove the alcohol, they're just naturally good, giving people. Not me, you know? Not me. You remove the alcohol, I'm still a selfish son of a bitch, you know? And so what it taught me is that if I want to feel good about what I do and feel good about myself, I have to take actions that are not natural to me. You know, I mean, I'll look at a situation and say, what would a good person do? You know? Well, they would be there and be of service. So I'll do that. And the only reason I do that is not because I'm wonderful, because I'm not. It's because I know how I'm going to feel if I don't take those actions. You know? So like I say, if you get here and you get sober and you get good, God bless you. Show me the way. You know? Because that's how I learned how to take good actions in Alcoholics Anonymous, is watching what people do. You know? And, at any rate, I hit about 13 years of sobriety, and I was kind of, you know, circling the drain. And I was up at this little conference we have out in the mountains every year, and they have a dance on Saturday night. And this newcomer came up to me, he had about 30 days, and he said, what's your concept of God? And I was like, you know, it's 10:30 at night. I'm trying, you know, I no longer dance, but I'm quite willing to watch you dance. You know, I'm trying to watch a little booty here, and, you know, he wants to talk about God at 10:30 on Saturday night, you know. And so we talked, and after an hour and a half, I realized that 30 days, this young man had a better concept of God than I did at 13 years. I'd been paying lip service to God. That would be for me. I went and asked a man to take me through the steps, I asked Clint to take me through the steps, and we sat down, and I had an experience with the steps that I urge all of you to take, to go through the book and go through the steps thoroughly. And it, out of that experience came an absolute conviction that there is a God in my life at all times, and he's always been there. And if that's the only thing you get from the steps, then you're more than well paid, you know. I'm the kind of person that, you know, it may be raining, you know, chunks of gold from heaven, you know, but I'm busy looking for a penny on the street because I just don't get the big picture. And I found that going through the steps gave me the big picture about who I am and whose I am. You know, I'm God's. I'm God's. I got to tell you, I have two kids. I have a 20-year-old and a 24-year-old. When my son was 16 years old, my 20-year-old, he attempted suicide. And if you're a parent, you know, it's the worst day of your life. It's just the worst day of your life. And people say, well, did you see it coming? And if you'd seen it coming, I would have done something, you know, I mean. And I remember we took him to the hospital, and I called my sponsor. And the first thing he said to me is, he said, you know, have you asked God into this situation? And I pulled the car over, and my wife and I got on our knees, and we asked God into that situation. You know, and that boy's okay today. And, you know, a number of things happened in the last couple of years. I had these dogs. I'm crazy about these boxers. And I had two of them, and they both died on me. And, you know, they break your heart. And then my father died. My father passed away. And I love my father, and I went to the funeral, and this is what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me, by the way. I went into the funeral, I walked into the room where they had him laid out, and I wept, and I walked out. That is a normal reaction to a situation. It's not my reaction. I'm abnormal. I don't know how to deal with situations. 20 years of Alcoholics Anonymous has allowed me and taught me to have an emotion that is inappropriate to the situation, which is a lot for somebody like me. I was at the doctor's about 2 years ago, and you know, I was hitting 50 years old, and I'm like, I think I'm having a heart attack every day, you know? It's a heart attack, I know it, you know? It's lumbago, I know it, you know? I mean, it's just one of those things where you just... Well, because I'm paranoid and I'm thinking about myself all the time anyway. So I went to the doctor and I started describing my symptoms, you know, so that I could get the full body scan. I'm convinced that a full body scan will reveal hidden pockets of cancer and heart disease. And I can go, aha, I was right. I'm dying, but I'm right. And so I'm describing the symptoms to my doctor, and he stopped me halfway through. And he said, you're not having a heart attack, idiot. He said, I know what you have, and there's a simple solution. He said, these are physical signs of depression. And I have the cure. And I went, oh God, you know, here it comes. And I said, well, you know, listen, you know, I'm an AA, and I'm an alcoholic, and da-da-da-da. And I said, I got to talk to my sponsor. And he said, it's no big deal, it's just a prescription. I said, you know, I got to talk to my sponsor. Now, I'm bringing this up because I don't want to open a can of worms here. That is not my job here today, is open some sort of can of worms about this or that. All I can tell you is my experience. This is what happened for me. I called my sponsor, and I said, well, he wants to prescribe this, and he said, well, you need to do what you have to do. And I said, no, I'm asking for direction. He said, well, then my direction is no. I said, I just wanted to hear it. You know what I mean? Because it was a medical doctor that prescribed it to me, so I'm going, oh, great, it's a medical doctor. It's not even, I didn't even go to a shrink, and he wants me to, yeah. And he said, no. I said, okay, that's all I had to hear. He said, listen, he said, you've had a lot happen to you in the last year, you know, with your son and your father and your dogs dying. He said, you're not talking to me about this. Are you talking to anyone else about it? And I said, well, no, not really. He said, gee, any wonder you're depressed? Are you using the program in any way, shape, or form to deal with any of this? Well, no, not really. Gosh, could be you might be depressed doing that, don't you think? And so what I did is I didn't take that prescription. But I did start talking to my sponsor, started talking to AA brothers, people that I was close to, and you know, it's an amazing thing. Got better, you know. And that was just my experience. But if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I really beg that you stay. Not just for you, but for me too. A few years ago, I was driving down the road, and I heard an ad on the radio for home loans. It said, "Get the loan you deserve." And, you know, I started thinking, well, this ad is designed for people who don't deserve a loan, you know, or else they would have got one already, you know. And I started thinking about what I deserve, because what I deserve is a big topic with me, you know. I deserve a lot. And I started really thinking about it. What I deserve is to be on my sixth marriage. What I deserve is to be dead or drunk in the gutter. I deserve to be featured on an episode of Cops. Running through the trailer park, you know, with a bad tattoo going, "You don't understand, I was an English major, you know." That's what I deserve, you know. That's what I deserve, not what I have, you know. If you're new, I really hope you stay. Whatever you're thinking right now, you know, as Keith L. says, you're wrong. You know, I know when I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought, you know, this is it. This is the worst thing that could have happened to me. I was wrong. I'm wrong about just about everything, by the way, and I'm grateful for it, too, because I have a negative attitude. And if I was right, the whole earth would have gone up in a ball of fire a long time ago. And so if you're new, I want to tell you you're wrong, and it's the best thing that could happen. And if you're new, I want to tell you I hope you stay around, because I hope you don't get what you deserve, whatever you think it is. I hope you stay here, stay sober, and you get what we've got, which is a life beyond our wildest dreams. Thanks for letting me share.